This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Lily Bart is a smart, witty, single New Yorker and stunningly beautiful. She's at parties every night and on the prowl for a husband. But Lily is anxious. She's turning 30 and struggling to manage her money, her friendships, romance. This isn't a TV show. It's Edith Wharton's 1905 novel, The House of Mirth. The book sold 140,000 copies its first year, an enormous bestseller. And although the social world it depicted was in its final days even then, the novel feels strangely modern. In today's episode of our American Icon series, Studio 360's Michelle Siegel steps inside The House of Mirth.
So, how many times have you read the book?
Probably 20 times or more. I've read it so many times, and every time I see something different in it.
I've studied it.
I did fall in love with it because of not only the marvelous use of English, I mean, it's wonderfully written, but it is the most savage satire.
It has all the attributes of a romance. You are seduced by this notion of happiness and delight, and the end is so shattering.
The House of Mirth opens in Grand Central Station. It's where the bachelor Lawrence Selden spots Lily Bart.
Selden had never seen her more radiant. Her vivid head, relieved against the dull tints of the crowd, made her more conspicuous than in a ballroom. And under her dark hat and veil, she regained the girlish smoothness, the purity of tint that she was beginning to lose after 11 years of late hours and indefatigable dancing.
Here's what you need to know about the book. It's New York City, just before the turn of the 20th century. Lily Bart is 29 years old. Her parents have died, and her family money is gone. Her beauty is beginning to fade, the very looks where her value lies. A wealthy aunt takes her in, but Lily's spending and gambling habits go far beyond her allowance. The House of Mirth chronicles Lily's quest to find a husband, and fast. For Lily, this means saying yes to every social function.
She looked down the long table, studying its occupants one by one. How dreary and trivial these people were. Lily reviewed them with a scornful impatience. Carrie Fisher with her shoulders, her eyes, her divorces. Young Silverton, who had meant to live on proofreading and write an epic, and who now lived on his friends and had become critical of truffles.
Nothing is said, nothing overtly savage happens. But below the surface, you know, I mean, you're in deadly danger from the moment you get up till the moment you go to bed. And that's what's terrifying.
Terrence Davies wrote and directed the 2000 film adaptation of The House of Mirth. He took a lot of his dialogue straight from Wharton. In this scene, a friend warns Lily about the backstabbing ways of their mutual acquaintance, Bertha Dorset.
Oh, I don't say there's any real harm in Bertha, but she delights in making people miserable, especially her husband. Poor George. But she is dangerous. And you're not nasty. And for always getting what she wants in the long run, commend me to a nasty woman.
I thought you were so fond of Bertha.
Oh, I am. It's much safer to be fond of dangerous people.
The upper class here is gross and animalistic and horrendous, totally immoral.
Hildegard Huller teaches American literature at the City University of New York.
Wharton calls it the tyranny of the tea tray. You know, the minute the tea tray comes into the room, everybody has assigned roles. Certain things can no longer be said, can no longer be done. Everybody has to perform according to that tyranny.
The book had all the trappings you'd see in a novel of manners, like something from Jane Austen, but with an edge. Wharton was one of the first American novelists to write about money and class. With finance capitalism on the rise, people were getting rich quickly, not just inheriting their wealth. In The House of Mirth, old money clashed with new. It made the novel a sensation. And writer Roxana Robinson says American readers hadn't seen a tragic heroine like Lily Bart before.
Well, I would compare it to Anna Karenina. There was this notion of the upper classes, the classes of privilege. And when they were written about, they were perceived as conquerors and triumphant. So those endings were usually happy. And to have this interior view of a world that most people only saw from the outside, and to see the extraordinary pain that could be felt there, was just a revelation, I think.
Robinson first read the novel as a teenager. She had a glamorous aunt, a former model who worked at Vogue, who turned her on to the book. Robinson immediately related to the endless social rules Lily has to obey. The suffocating world depicted in the book was also Edith Wharton's reality.
She was still stuck in this circle of people who judged her on the length of her skirt and the set of her shoulders.
A woman is asked out as much for her clothes as for herself. The clothes are the background, the frame, if you like. They don't make success, but they are a part of it. Who wants a dingy woman?
Wharton was not a beauty, and she wasn't rich. So it wasn't for 6 years that she became engaged, and he wasn't a catch. Edward Wharton was 12 years older than she was. He'd never had a job. He lived with his mother, and his father was in an insane asylum. Writing saved her sanity, and certainly was her greatness, but she still was held a prisoner in a marriage and a life that she couldn't escape from.
So it's not an autobiography of Wharton, but it is like an emotional autobiography of her.
Yes. She was writing in The House of Mirth about what happens to a woman who loses that central vein of forward motion. There's nowhere for her to go. So I think in that way, she's not punishing Lily. She's saying, this is what it feels like to me. I am devastated and I am suicidal.
Everything in the past seemed simple, natural, full of daylight, and she was alone in a place of darkness and pollution. Alone. It was the loneliness that frightened her.
Some modern readers might dismiss this as turn-of-the-century chick lit, but Edith Wharton wasn't just making entertainment. She took a risk in writing seriously about women's lives and emotions. Through Lily, she posed questions women and men still ask. How will we lead our lives? What will become of us? And Wharton didn't stop there. She critiqued the society she lived in. She exposed how it treated women and how it was governed by money, class, and taste.
Every couch, every pillow, every meal is about the sense of entrapment and the sense of being determined by those things. And taste is something you can't acquire, even though you can have the money, but you can't have the class because you don't have the taste.
Lily's goal is to keep her footing in the upper class, but the very notion of class that Lily aspires to, well, it was becoming nostalgic. This plays out in her relationship with Sim Rosedale. He's a successful investor and single, but he's an outsider because he's Jewish. Rosedale needs Lily to help him climb the social ladder. Early on in the novel, Lily is repulsed by him. She rejects his advances. A year passes, and she's in a much more desperate situation. She tells him she's ready to marry him. But now, he sees things differently.
Miss Lily, what I mean...
What you mean to say is that I am not as desirable a match as once you thought me.
You know as well as I do, last year you wouldn't look at me. Now you appear willing to do so. What's changed in the interval? Your situation. Then you thought you could do better.
You think you can?
Yes, I do.
I mean, all of Edith Wharton's books are about money. There's an exchange in every single encounter. It's an exchange of value.
In the 1990s, Candace Bushnell began to write about the same themes, first in her newspaper columns and then in her novel, Sex and the City.
The exchange of being seen with the right person will elevate you in society. There's always a tit for tat, and that is still very, very true in New York society. It goes on under the surface, or it's blatant.
What are you getting so uptight about? I mean, money is power. Sex is power. Therefore, getting money for sex is simply an exchange of power.
Don't listen to the dime store Camille Paglia.
I don't know whether to take it as an incredible compliment or as an incredible insult.
Just take it, period.
Well, the Sex and the City TV series was based on Bushnell's book and starred Sarah Jessica Parker as Carrie Bradshaw.
You guys, I'm gonna write the whole thing off as a bad date with a cash bonus.
Bushnell had very early on try to kind of position herself with Wharton, really, as something of a kind of social commentator on this milieu of privileged New York society. They kind of move in broadly similar circles 100 years apart.
That's Deborah German. She lectures on contemporary television at Roehampton University in London.
What's interesting about both Lily and Carrie, they're both kind of really caught up in that world and seduced by that world, but they also stand outside it sometimes and criticise it and feel uncomfortable in it.
Younger and plainer girls had been married off by the dozens, and she was 9 and 20 and still Miss Bart. She was beginning to have fits of angry rebellion against fate when she longed to drop out of the race and make an independent life for herself. But what manner of life would it be?
What if Prince Charming had never showed up? Would Snow White have slept in that glass coffin forever? Or would she have eventually woken up, spit out the apple, gotten a job, a healthcare package, and a baby from her local neighborhood sperm bank? Couldn't help but wonder.
So does it surprise you that in this respect so little has changed? I mean, so much has changed in 100 years, but also so little?
Well, although women have clearly moved on, you know, underneath it all, there's this kind of continuing strand of the difficulty of what marriage represents for women, the difficulty of kind of gender inequity that still exists between men and women, despite the fact that women clearly have, you know, careers that they couldn't have dreamed of 100 years ago. What Walton kind of shows is how difficult it is for women to maintain or pursue close friendships. By the time we get to Sex and the City, key difference is that you know, women are able to kind of celebrate their friendships together.
Don't laugh at me, but maybe we could be each other's soulmates.
Well, that sounds like a plan.
Just before I started writing Sex and the City, a girlfriend and I had read House of Mirth, and we vowed that we must never end up like Lily Bart. It was kind of eye-opening that if you are kind of hoping that in some way you're going to be saved by society, you really may not be.
By the end of the book, Lily gets fired from a hatmaker's workshop. Her stitching just wasn't up to snuff. And so with very little money left, she's forced to live in a boarding house.
Her whole past was reenacting itself at 100 different points of consciousness. Where was the drug that could still this legion of insurgent nerves? She put out her hand and measured the soothing drops into a glass. But as she did so, she knew they would be powerless against the supernatural lucidity of her brain. She had long since raised the dose to its highest limit, but tonight she felt she must increase it. She knew she took a slight risk in doing so. She remembered the chemist's warning. If sleep came at all, it might be a sleep without waking.
Lily Bart doesn't wake up.
What do you do if you think you know the rules and then you don't and you're destroyed by them? But in that process, you find that you have moral integrity.
This character whom you have come to live in as yourself, you live in Lily Bart's mind.
We identify with her weakness, and most of us are quite entrapped ourselves. We want fashion, we want to be beautiful, we compromise ourselves.
And you're so hoping that she's going to find the pinnacle of the life that she's capable of. And it's so devastating to see her descend from those heights. And to realize that Wharton constructs this perfectly. There is no other ending that's possible for Lily Bart. There's nothing else.
Edith Wharton created a breakthrough novel, and The House of Mirth was her personal breakthrough, too. She was 43 years old when it was published, and it gave her success and freedom she'd never had before. And in 1920, she won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, a first for a woman, for her novel The Age of Innocence. Towards the end of her life, Wharton wrote an autobiography. It's called A Backward Glance, and in it, she tells a story about her time as a war correspondent in France during World War I. She went to ask a French official for permission to go to a battlefield, and the official refused her, but then he went to go talk to the general, and when he returned, he says to Wharton, "Are you the author of The House of Mirth? Because if so, the general says, you can have a pass." For Studio 360, I'm Michelle Siegel.
Anne-Marie Nest read from the novel. At Studio360.org, you can see pages from the first edition of The House of Mirth and hear the novelist Jonathan Franzen talk about why it's one of his all-time favorite books.